From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the death of Marine recruit Raheel Siddiqui of Taylor forced a probe into brutality and hazing on Parris Island. Now his drill instructor is being court-martialed for abusing Siddiqui and other Muslim recruits.
He's accused of hitting, of punching, of kicking several recruits while he was a drill instructor there.
Plus, the effects of screen time on kids and parents.
What the research is showing is that most people use much more than they realize, not just for work, not just sitting in front of a desktop and sending emails and finding information, but outside of work.
Happy 60th birthday to the Mackinac Bridge, a marvel of engineering.
That bridge is designed to be constantly in motion, even up to 35 feet lateral movement in high wind.
Those stories and more on Stateside today. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up later this hour, the latest from Camp Lejeune in North Carolina, where the court-martial of Raheel Siddiqui's drill instructor is underway. But first, Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly today activated the State Emergency Operations Center, the center to coordinate the state's response to an outbreak of hepatitis A. It's hit southeast Michigan pretty hard over the last 15 months, and the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services wants to keep this outbreak from spreading around the state. Jay Fiedler is with the MDHHS, where he manages the Surveillance and Infectious Disease Epidemiology section. Jay, it's pretty safe to say people know hepatitis is dangerous. You don't want to get it. Most of us, though, don't know the differences between the different types of hepatitis and why it's dangerous.
Hepatitis A, as you've said, is a fairly common virus in some respects. It is well known to public health. It's well known to the general population, we feel, and is a vaccine-preventable disease that we are concerned with and monitor as a reportable disease here in Michigan. It is generally spread in what we call in public health a fecal-oral route, so people with contaminated hands or surfaces can easily pass this virus from person to person, and as well as some high-risk situations that we see where this virus can be spread easily between groups, such as people who travel to countries where hepatitis A is more endemic, men who have sex with men, users of injection and non-injection drugs, and then other household members and contacts of either children or folks who have come down with a hepatitis A infection.
Jay, what does the hepatitis A virus do? Attack our liver?
That's exactly what it does. It does primarily cause a general disease onset that's nausea, fever, malaise, abdominal pain, but ultimately the major clinical concern is with how it does impact the liver.
Now, the latest report from your department says 457 confirmed cases of hepatitis A with 18 fatalities since August 1st, 2016. And these cases largely confined to Southeast Michigan?
Yes. Right now, we're looking at approximately 11 counties and local health jurisdictions in Southeast Michigan. We are starting to see that kind of expand a little bit. The most recent counties that have been added to that outbreak have been Ingham County, Lapeer County, Sanilac County, and Washtenaw County.
So what would this newly activated operations center be able to do to kind of first contain this outbreak and secondly end it?
My understanding of the operations center is that it's going to really help us facilitate the response from MDHHS and our response across divisions and bureaus within our organization, and then also help us partner with other agencies at the state, like Michigan State Police and the Department of Agriculture and Rural Development, and get those activities coordinated on a larger level to help us with planning and operations and really to execute plans in how we can contain and hopefully eradicate.
And what is the battle plan?
The immediate battle plan right now, we are working with providers and local health departments to try to increase awareness as much as possible. Immediately, we want to see prompter diagnosis and reporting and follow-up of these cases. One of the things that we try to do with hepatitis A is really evaluate each of these new cases, determine if we have folks who are high-risk individuals, whether that's because of behaviors like drug use, or maybe it's someone who works in a restaurant or a food establishment, and we really want to get in there and work with either other employees or patrons of that facility to get post-exposure prophylaxis and try to get vaccination response to the groups that are appropriate.
And the vaccination, that hepatitis A vaccine, I understand it's the most effective way to combat the disease. But what can you tell us about these temporary limitations of adult hep A vaccine?
Due to multiple outbreaks that are occurring throughout the United States, there are some strains on supplies from manufacturers. Currently, Michigan is working with our CDC contacts to try to ensure that we have enough vaccine to meet our immediate needs, and then we're also trying to project out into the future what our needs are going to be to respond to this. We have secured adequate amounts of vaccine right now in order to respond, and we think that we're okay here in the near term. And then, as I said, we're working on the long-term plan to assure that we can sustain that response.
So the main action steps the public should take would be what, Jay?
Number one, more than anything, wash your hands. Washing your hands and proper hand hygiene is one of the most effective steps to protect yourself from hepatitis A. We are encouraging vaccination in high-risk groups and in response to any identified events where we've had a contaminated food worker or a household contact. If someone in your house has come down with hepatitis A, we strongly recommend getting post-exposure prophylaxis to keep that from transmitting throughout the household and then to other people that you know and in your community.
Jay, you're an epidemiologist. What is your feeling as far as what's behind this increased incidence in Michigan and, as you say, across the country? What's going on here?
Hepatitis A is a very difficult disease to control because it is highly infectious. We had basically a small elevation in southeast Michigan that we were watching towards the end of 2016 that really became more entrenched in that population early in 2017. We don't know exactly what caused it to really jump up in numbers. But the number one thing is just trying to get a response to all those high-risk cases and to get post-exposure prophylaxis in people. If one case slips through the cracks, you have the opportunity to really infect many additional individuals. And so when you start to see that in a population, as it ramps up, it gets more difficult to control. And so we're trying to mount a bigger response to try to get this thing under control.
Jay Fiedler with the MDHHS. Thanks for speaking with us, Jay.
Thank you.
Today is the first day of open enrollment for health coverage under the Affordable Care Act. This enrollment period is different from prior years. The Trump administration has cut the period to just 45 days from today through December 15th. It greatly cut money for advertising and slashed money for the navigators who help the people choose the best plan and guide them through the sign-up process. Dizzy Warren is executive director of Enroll Michigan. It's the agency that distributes that federal money to the navigator organizations on the ground. Dizzy, how hard was Michigan hit when the Trump administration slashed navigator funding?
Michigan was one of the heaviest hit states in the country. Overall, we experienced a 72% cut with all of the navigator budgets here.
Now, I understand in prior years you were getting a million, maybe even a little bit more than a million. What amount are you getting for this year?
In the last 4 years, we've received anything from $1.2 million to $1.4 million. This year in May, we were promised $1.2 million, and instead in September, we were informed that we were receiving $129,988 instead, which effectively amounted to an 89% cut.
An 89% cut. What is that cut going to mean for people being able to get to a navigator?
Well, fortunately, due to the generosity and a commitment of the navigator organizations in Michigan, consumers will not notice, they will probably notice little or nothing in terms of their ability to meet with an assister. Primarily, this is due to the fact that of the 28 organizations we were planning to work with, 24 organizations decided that the work was important enough for them to do it anyway. And the four that are not, that were not able to move on without funding, they fortunately are in areas where there are other navigators. So consumers should not notice anything really in terms of their ability to meet with an assister.
And so I can tell you have a lot of praise for these groups that say that's all right, it's important, and we'll do it without that federal funding.
That I can't say enough about them, because the good news is that these organizations have been with us since year one. So they know the work. They know how important it is to be available. They've been serving consumers in their own counties since, you know, the last 4 years. It is not that they're doing it for free. They just are in a position where they can move money around in their agencies to cover this period.
Dizzy, will we see any differences in access to navigators based on location or regions of Michigan?
The 24 organizations, instead of serving as we have in the past, we used to cover all 83 counties in Michigan. But with these 24 organizations, we're going to be covering 77 counties instead. So there is one section of Michigan, primarily northern lower Michigan is what we call it, that there will not be a navigator. But fortunately, in our state, we also have hundreds of certified application counselors. And in the areas where there are no navigators, consumers can still get one-on-one assistance from certified application counselors.
So navigators are there, but certainly with this much shorter sign-up period, it sounds like consumers need to get to it and not delay.
That's the biggest thing. Fortunately, the Affordable Care Act is still the law of the land. The benefits for consumers who sign up, who are eligible through the marketplace, are still there. Even though rates have gone up, the way the premiums are actually working out is that consumers should not notice any real difference in premium prices. So the big concern right now for us in Michigan is that, and I'm sure it's true around the country, is that we have this extremely shortened enrollment period that was not advertised, because as you know, that budget was also cut. And so what we're trying to do is to make sure consumers know 6 weeks is all we have, and you need to get started as early as possible, especially if you think you might need the help of an assister, because they're going to get booked up pretty fast as well.
Dizzy Warren, Executive Director of Enroll Michigan. Dizzy, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome, and thank you.
Still to come, we'll talk about the negative side effects of digital technology and what we should be doing about it.
I think the bottom line is as little screen time as absolutely possible.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, no question about it, digital technology has infused our lives. And while it brings many benefits, we are paying a price for having our brains constantly plugged into this digital world. At special risk, children and adolescents. But let's talk about the effect of screen time on kids and parents and what we should do about it. We turn now to Scott Becker and Aislinn Sapp. Scott's director of the Counseling Center at Michigan State University. Aislinn is with the Office of Student Affairs and Services at MSU. Aislinn, to be fair, before we get into the negative side effects of digital technology, social media, video games, apps, what do you see as some of the positive things about it in terms of mental health?
Certainly access is probably one of the biggest positive things I see. You know, it provides people who either are geographically isolated with a way into treatment or a way into help seeking. It's also really important in terms of lowering the stigma and lowering that threshold of access. So we do know that, you know, people who won't walk into a counseling center, for example, and say, I need some help, might answer or write an email about it or look on a blog or send a tweet or text someone if they're feeling upset, suicidal, overwhelmed, in crisis. So certainly in terms of that first entryway into services, there's a lot of positives. There's a lot of support that can happen in terms of online community. People with certain diagnoses or who are living and struggling with certain mental health conditions can find a lot of support online in terms of that community and that sense of belonging and finding, you know, kids who are growing up maybe in a region of the country where they don't have a lot of people like themselves. That can really be a lifesaver, finding that access online.
So we can kind of use digital technology to help create and sustain a sense of community and intimacy, which is good. But now, Scott, let's flip the coin. What is digital technology doing that has more kids seeking help for mental health issues? How's it affecting them?
What we're finding is that the critical deficit that's happening is in the right hemisphere, which generally speaking influences emotion regulation, memory, impulse control, and it's also the integration between the right hemisphere, which governs emotions, and the left hemisphere, which is logic and impulse control. So what we're seeing are underdeveloped capacities for understanding our feelings, for naming them, for communicating those to other people, and really for putting on the emotional brakes. There's less of a capacity to self-soothe. That's one of the terms in psychotherapy. And so emotion regulation, impulse control, distress tolerance is lower than it used to be. So a similar situation that a student might have faced 10 or 20 years ago and was manageable then is not as manageable now. So we're seeing students coming in with panic episodes and with chronic distress related to a lack of social connection. So we're seeing social media replacing face-to-face communication, which if we now look at the developmental literature, is the way in which a lot of these emotional structures develop. Aislinn is a developmental specialist, and I'll let her address some of that. But what we're seeing is the absence of adequate levels of social interaction are causing some of these problems.
I got to imagine sleep has got to be an issue, because I know these kids are going to, you know, they've got the phone next to them in bed. They're waking up during the night checking messages. That has to affect brains, right?
Absolutely, it does. You know, sleep is one of the most important things in terms of, I mean, for all of us, but certainly if you think about the developing brain, there's not much that's more important outside of, you know, nutrition, safety. Sleep is right up there. And there are a lot of factors there. There's the one you just mentioned, that kind of fear of missing out. So I'm checking the phone all night long. That happens to adults who have jobs, who feel like they can't miss an email or who might legitimately be on call. And then there's also issues with, you know, the blue light from the phone. There's a lot of research to suggest that that actually knocks down your melatonin, which is one of the things that's responsible for sleep onset. And so there are actual kind of physiological consequences to having these phones kind of right next to our beds all night long.
So we need to talk about first the little ones before we talk about the older ones, because how do we as parents or as caring grandparents keep this from happening when we have little ones in our care, so that it doesn't get to the point that you're seeing with these students coming in? What should be the guidelines for parents of youngsters, little ones?
I think the bottom line is as little screen time as absolutely possible. We have kids. Our kids are 8.5 and just turned 6, and they are certainly, they get TV time. You know, they even have tablets, but we are very, very conservative with respect to how much time they get. And we're very mindful of the balance between how much of their life is lived online and how much of their life is lived in the real world. And so, you know, we go outside, we play, we do not have any devices in the car, we don't have any devices at the dinner table, we watch TV with them, we talk to them, we make sure that they're living life in a real 3D world rather than primarily in an online setting.
I would just add that the first thing we recommend to parents and anyone working with kids is to examine their own levels of use.
Sure.
What the research is showing is that most people use much more than they realize, not just for work, not just sitting in front of a desktop and sending emails and finding information, but outside of work. And so the first thing would be to do what in AA is called a fearless and searching moral inventory, and really looking at the number of times a day that even short, let's say checking text messages, even short interruptions, how that impacts relationships and communication and satisfaction throughout the day, and focus, really, and the way it impacts parenting.
I've seen people pushing strollers, and mm-hmm. as they're pushing strollers, spending what should be time with their little one, they're texting. They're doing.
Yep.
They're pecking away at their smartphone.
Yep.
We see it in restaurants. You see them, you know,
yep.
The phone is not out of the hand. So that has to have an effect, being a digitally distracted parent, on the
yes.
child.
Absolutely. I mean, and you see it, you know, oftentimes if the kids aren't on their own devices, which as we've talked about is its own kind of problem, then they're escalating their own behavior in order to get the attention that they're not getting from their parents. you know, they need that one-on-one eye contact is so huge. Actually looking at a child when they ask you a question and answering the question, or getting down and playing with your kids, being with them when you're supposed to be with them, is really important.
I do hear a very clear challenge that parents need to look in the mirror and yeah. really do this self-analysis. What about, Scott, when we talk about middle school, high school, these, as they're getting set up for college and careers, how should parents approach talking to their teens about screen time and maybe reversing things that have been building for years?
Well, we encourage conversation. We encourage sharing information. We do an hour and a half or sometimes a three-hour workshop for schools and for parent groups. And what we're telling folks is, at a certain point, your teenager is going to do what they're going to do. And so the goal is to influence their decision-making, not just their behavior. So saying no while they're in your house is one thing, but it can build up resentment and an adversarial relationship. So what we're encouraging is share a version of this information with your kids and gear it toward whatever developmental level they happen to be at the moment. But make sure that they understand why you're saying no and why you're saying yes to other things. And encouraging them really to extend that conversation to their friends. If they're the only, say, eighth grader who's unplugging, likely, especially at first, they're going to feel rather isolated and alone and potentially ostracized because they're not on social media where, quote unquote, everything is happening. So this has to be done in conversation within the family. And then I think ultimately has to be in conversation with other families, with other parents, with other kids, so that there's a countercultural sort of a movement that gets started. And there's a sense of social connection that happens off of the devices. Without that, it's difficult to replace something that is, in many ways, quite literally addictive.
I would just add to what Scott said, you know, especially as kids get into high school and are moving on into college, the importance of talking with your kids about technology as a tool. I mean, this isn't going to go away. We need to be tech skilled in order to work in just about any field these days. But, you know, teenagers are still learning, and it's still very hard for them when they're upset, for example, or excited to put on the brakes. And so really teaching them about the fact that, you know, when you put something out there on Facebook, there's no guarantee you're ever going to get it off of Facebook. So that long-term thinking about what's that going to look like if a potential employer is researching your digital presence, and also really highlighting for them that 60% of communication is nonverbal. And so if you're trying to have an interaction with your friend, there are some things that are just better to do in person or over the phone, where you can hear the tone of their voice, where you're not going to misunderstand what they're saying. So giving them that skill set to say, you know what, maybe we shouldn't be talking about this on a Facebook chat. Can I call you?
Or a
because
text.
I'm not sure.
If I had a nickel for any every time I have said to...
Yep.
My kid, call them so you
yes.
could hear voices, the fights and the problems that can happen
yes.
because of that text message that has
yep.
no sense of context, no tone of voice.
Exactly.
What
yep.
is neuroplasticity, and how would that help both kids and adults recover from being addicted to our technology?
So kind of just basic neuroplasticity really refers to the ability of the human brain to reshape itself in response to experiences. So the idea that we are actually making new connections in the brain throughout the lifespan. We used to think that it was kind of primarily limited to childhood. And what we know now is even as adults, our brains are always adapting and changing to the environments that we put them in. And so with respect to technology, the more you use that as your primary means of interacting with the world, the more your brain's going to adapt to that in ways that Scott has kind of pointed out can become problematical. But the more we move away from that or move towards a more balanced lifestyle, the more our brains are going to adapt to that. And particularly with respect to kids, you know, the changes we see in kids are most profound, but they're also the easiest to correct the younger that they are. So the sooner you get them off the device, there's a lot of kind of research that looks at kids who do, let's say, tech-free camps for a week or two in the summer. And they show by the end of those 2 weeks, decreases in anxiety, increases in empathy, increases in positive affect. So the changes can be pretty dramatic and pretty quick with even just a few small changes.
Scott, do you worry that it's too late for us to get our arms around this?
Yes, at times I do. My fear is that the forces that are generating the technology are so endemic to the culture, they're so global, And they're so, I alluded to addiction earlier, they're designed to be addictive. There's a lab, for example, at Stanford, and app and web designers go there to learn how to make their programs more physiologically addictive. So the product that's being sold is not, as Aislinn said, just a tool. It can be used as a tool, but the minute we slide into social media and other forms of media consumption, there's a sense in which we need more and more of it, or our bodies come to think that they do. So there are times when I feel that because this is the water we're swimming in, because everyone's drug is in their front pocket, that this is going to take a rather global, rather pronounced effort on everybody's part to unplug and to become aware. So the good news is there are a lot of researchers and journalists and writers looking at this issue and getting the word out, educators as well. So I think there can be a positive tipping point. We're just trying to be part of that conversation.
Scott Becker and Aislinn Sapp from Michigan State University, thank you so much for speaking with us and giving parents a lot of food for thought.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Charlotte Manzik has a mission, spreading kindness on the playground. Charlotte is a fifth grader at Maltby Intermediate School in Brighton, and by taking careful note of hurtful things that can happen during school recess, she came up with a way to include everyone in recess activities. The result? Recess Club, K-L-U-B. It stands for Kindness and Leadership Uniting Buddies. Charlotte Manzik is with us now, along with her mom, Nicole, and welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
So good to have you here. So, Charlotte, what did you see happening on the playground at recess that got you thinking that something wasn't right?
Well, it wasn't exactly what was happening at recess. One night, my sister came home, and we were both going to sleep, and she started crying because she didn't have anybody to play with at recess anymore. She's been playing with these two girls for a long time, ever since kindergarten, and they kind of split up because one went and played soccer, and the other was playing with a group that didn't really want CL to join. So she was hurting, and that's when I was thinking, how could people not want to play with my sister? I loved her so much. She was my biggest idol. So then I asked my mom, what if there was a club at school where if people didn't have anybody to play with, they could go to, so they always had someone to play with?
And what grade were you in when you started noticing this?
First grade.
That's pretty perceptive, Mom.
Yes.
What did you encourage her to do when she proposed that idea?
Well, I thought it was such a pure and sweet idea, and the summer was coming, and during the summer, we usually try to come up with activities for the kids to do, and I said, wow, that's such a great idea. Why don't you work on that idea over the summer, and then maybe you can propose it to your principal after the summer? And she asked for a folder and a pen, and away she went and started working on the plans for the club.
So you worked away, and now this idea that you had has grown up into Recess Club. What is Recess Club? How does it work?
Well, I make a recruitment video, and it's sent out to each of the grades, and leaders, they apply to be a Recess Club leader so they can search the playground to see if people are alone. And if they are alone, then they will ask, would you like to play with me, or if you would like to play an organized activity, which is where the other Recess Club leaders come into play, where the other half will go and they will organize a game, and everybody's allowed to join. And some days people even who were not alone came and joined, and then kindness and leadership bloomed during recess.
So this is asking students to look around, kind of be aware that there are people being left out. So you're not relying on teachers or parents who are playground monitors or the like. You're asking students to do it.
Yes, because we believe that students should be able to support all of their fellow classmates. And when students are doing it, it makes them feel like they're a part of something, and they do have people standing by their side, even when times may be tough between them and their friends.
Nicole, how did you feel watching your daughter come up with this idea, essentially to help her older sister?
Well, of course, as a mother, it made me extremely proud. But when she came up with the idea, I was overwhelmed with that kind of an idea coming out of my young child. But it was also such a simple idea, and it kind of put things into perspective for me as a mother, and has as she's worked on this club, that the small things in life sometimes can produce the biggest results.
Well, you can find out more about Recess Club, and again, it's KLUB, Kindness and Leadership Uniting Buddies, by going to their Facebook page. We've been talking with Charlotte Manzik, the founder of Recess Club. She's a fifth grader at Maltby Intermediate School in Brighton, and with her mom, Nicole Manzik. Thanks so much for sharing your work with us here on Stateside.
Thank you so much, Cindy.
Coming up, it's the Mighty Max 60th birthday.
It's an engineering marvel. It's still the largest suspension bridge in the Western Hemisphere, the third largest in the world.
We will talk about this iconic symbol of Michigan after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On March 18, 2016, new Marine recruit Raheel Siddiqui of Taylor died after falling in his barracks on Parris Island, South Carolina. A coroner ruled the fall was suicide. But Siddiqui's family insists he was a devout Muslim and would never have committed suicide. And they filed a $100 million lawsuit against the U.S. Marines in their son's death. The investigation into Siddiqui's death and other incidents involving Muslim recruits has led to the biggest hazing scandal on Parris Island since six Marine recruits drowned there during a nighttime march in April 1956. A court-martial for Raheel Siddiqui's drill instructor began Tuesday at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. Gunnery Sergeant Joseph Felix is accused of slapping Siddiqui just before the fatal fall. Todd Spangler of the Detroit Free Press covered this opening day and is with us now. Now, Todd, this court-martial is not about the death of Raheel Siddiqui?
Not exclusively, and it looks as though the incidents surrounding recruit Siddiqui's death will only be barely touched on in this trial. This is really more about the prosecution's allegations that Gunnery Sergeant Felix maltreated several recruits, three of whom are of Muslim faith. And really what's interesting about this is that Siddiqui's death brought so much attention to this and really sort of changed what's going on at Parris Island, raised all these investigations to a high profile. But now it appears that because the belief is, or the government's feeling that is that he committed suicide, that they're not making the connection, the direct connection between Gunnery Sergeant Felix's actions and Raheel Siddiqui's death.
And the Siddiqui family was not present in the courtroom?
No, they are not here. It's not known whether they're going to try to come down maybe for closings or for the verdict, but it's somewhat understandable. Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, where this case is happening, is really it's not very close to Michigan. It would be a hardship to get down here. And as I say, a lot of what's going on in the courtroom is based around alleged other incidents involving hazing that Gunnery Sergeant Felix is accused of.
Let's talk about some of those actions he's accused of with Raheel Siddiqui, as well as you say, two other Muslim recruits. What particular things is he accused of doing?
In the overall, I mean, he's accused of hitting, of punching, of kicking several recruits while he was a drill instructor there, some of them in his own platoons, some of them in other platoons. You know, he's accused of referring to Muslim Marines as terrorists and taking other actions against them. In the case of Siddiqui, he's directly accused of slapping him just before recruit Siddiqui got up, ran out a door, and apparently jumped or fell to his death three stories down in March of 2016, as you said. The main thing that this case seems to be revolving around, however, is an incident in the summer of 2015, 2.5 years ago now, where a Muslim recruit, Amir Bormesh, who's still a Marine, alleges that Felix and another drill instructor ordered him into an industrial-sized dryer on Paris Island at the base, turned it on several times, burning him, referred to him as a terrorist, and took other actions demeaning his faith, it's in effect insisting that he renounce that faith at certain times and doing things like that. That's, so far, that's clearly what the prosecution is centering on in making the case against Felix.
In your story in today's Free Press, I actually did see that he ordered one of the recruits to pretend to cut the head off of another recruit while shouting Allahu Akbar.
Right. The prosecution is arguing that, and Lance Corporal now, Bormesh, says that these two drill instructors, Gunnery Sergeant Felix and another one, Staff Sergeant Michael Eldridge, who's not charged in this case, at some point did tie him up, continued to haze him over his Muslim faith, and then gave him what's known as a scush brush. It's a brush that you would clean up the floor with, and order him to pretend that he was sawing the head off of another recruit while that other recruit was bent over some footlockers. We continue to hear a lot of testimony about this. I have to say that the government's case so far is the recruits we've heard of so far 2 days in have differing remembrances of this, so it's sort of all over the board. But clearly that's how Bormesh remembers it, and that's what Felix is charged with doing.
And how has Felix's attorney defended these actions?
Gunnery Sergeant Felix's defense lawyer, Lieutenant Commander Clay Bridges, has throughout this said that these are not true, that Felix was a good drill instructor who was, if he did anything, was attempting to train his Marine recruits in the best way possible, and that anything that beyond that was really sort of a fabrication, almost the imagination of these recruits, taking maybe certain instances that happened and then blowing them out of proportion.
And what was Gunnery Sergeant Joseph Felix's demeanor as these recruits and as this Marine, this Lance Corporal Bormesh, is telling his story?
So far, he has sat in the courtroom stone-faced, not betraying any emotion whatsoever. He doesn't look angry. He doesn't look pleased. Literally, he's been without emotion throughout this. There's a woman in the courtroom, we believe is his wife, who's been sitting with him to give him support. But, so far, there haven't been any outbursts in the case. The judge is keeping a very close rein on both sides before the panel, which is before the jury in this case, which is made up of 8 male Marines. And so, yeah, there hasn't been any sort of outburst or really much emotion that Felix has shown in the court.
Now, how long is this trial expected to last?
The inside estimate is 2 weeks. The prosecution tells me that they expect their side of this case to last at least 2.5 weeks. And then you would get to the defense side, which could be even longer. We're looking at 75 to 80 or more witnesses if they call everyone that they're expecting that they might. And as trials are wont to do, you end up with sidebars at the bench. You end up with the jury being sent out so that the lawyers can talk to the judge about other things. It could even be longer than that.
And Todd, what is at stake for Gunnery Sergeant Felix if he's found guilty? Could he? What kind of time might he serve in a military prison?
Sure, that's really. It all depends on how this thing works out. He's charged with numerous counts of maltreatment and cruelty, of disobeying general orders not to hurt recruits or haze recruits, of obstruction of justice, drunk and disorderly in one case, giving false statements. Many of those charges include confinement time, which could be a year to 5 years. If you stretched all those out, consecutively, it would be looking at a pretty long sentence. It's unlikely that he'd be facing that. The truth is here is that when you take off of this Siddiqui's death as him being culpable of that, which they clearly have done, it's unlikely that he's going to be looking at any real sizable length of time, if any, in behind bars, regardless of what happens here. Beyond that, you may be looking at, loss of pay, dishonorable discharge, all of the things that the military also considers when they're looking at punishing someone, and which we should minimize. To someone who's made their career out of this is a very big deal. But I don't think that we're looking at decades, even if he were found guilty of everything. That's just unlikely in a case like this.
Todd Spangler covering this military court-martial at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. Thank you so very much.
Thank you much.
We know them as the greatest generation, the men and women who served in World War II. Some time ago on Stateside, we marked Veterans Day by talking with Murray Cotter of Beverly Hills. This Oakland County World War II vet joined the Army Air Corps in 1943. He served as a bombardier on a B-24, a liberator, flying missions in the war in the Pacific.
Now, I didn't want to be a walking soldier. I enlisted in the Army Air Corps. We were kept busy, though, for 13 missions is all we ended up getting.
Murray Cotter became my friend thanks to Honor Flight Michigan. He was one of a group of vets who called themselves the Flyboys, men who faced death in the skies over the Pacific and Europe, flying B-17s and B-24s. And then they came home to Michigan. Murray Cotter passed away last Saturday. He was 95 years young, and I'm going to miss him very, very much. It's a reminder, hug and thank those World War II vets while we still can.
The United Nations considers a war stopped even more important than a war won.
If our cities go down, in my opinion, our nation will go down.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
All we were trying to do was just get music for all people.
It's Wednesday, time to talk some Michigan history, and State Archivist Mark Harvey of the Michigan History Center is here with us, and we get to begin, Mark, by saying happy 60th birthday to an iconic Michigan landmark, which is...
The Mighty Mack.
Wow. Today, the official birthday of the Mighty Mack Bridge, the Mackinac Bridge. Why is that today? What happened November 1st, 1957?
Construction started in 1954. And it actually was completed at the end of the season in 1957. So by November 1st, there's some decisions to be made. And one was, you know, we got to open this thing before it sits all winter. And also part of the 100 million plus construction bond to build the bridge was to decommission the car ferries that had been taking cars across the straits for 20, 30 years. And so it makes sense to decommission those ships at the end of the shipping season instead of starting another season up and then halfway through decommissioning those. So there were actually two opening ceremonies. One was November 1st. It was actually open to traffic then in 1957. And then also there was another celebration in June of 58.
Now, how much of a big deal was opening this 5-mile span of suspension bridge 60 years ago?
It was huge. If you think about historically that this is a span that separated the two halves of the state since we settled the Toledo War and were given the Upper Peninsula as part of the state's boundaries. There was no bridge here until 1957. It was a big deal. The St. Ignace newspapers, they talked about the thousands of cars that were lined up waiting to cross opening day, November 1st. I think the stats go 930 cars crossed in the first hour, 3,005 cars crossed in the first 10 hours. There was a quote saying, this was the biggest achievement in the last 100 years of Michigan's history, which I'm sure Henry Ford and Ransom Olds might argue the
might
point.
Beg to differ.
Right. But it was yeah. It was monumental.
Yes, and it still is. It's absolutely magnificent to behold. Do we have any clue how many vehicles have traveled across the Mackinac Bridge over these past six decades?
Couldn't find the exact number, but the anniversary for the 100 millionth crossing was 1998. And then I think we average around 2.5 to 3. I think last year was 3.2 million crossings. So we're upon 150 million crossings of that bridge.
So what are a few things, Mark, that most of us might be surprised to know about the Mighty Mack?
There's a lot, actually. I'm surprised how many people don't know that it's 5 miles long. That's one of those stats that some people know it, a lot of people don't. So it's 5 miles long. It has, depending on what source you go from, 41 or 42,000 miles of cable.
Wow.
Let that sink in. 42,000 miles of cable on
it. Amazing.
The towers and large portions of the bridge were originally painted rust orange. It's not the color you see today. The cabling was green, but the towers were, and some of the causeways were largely orange. There's a trolley that runs underneath the bridge that moves the maintenance crew to different maintenance spots along the bridge. I think it's also important to remember that even though it opened November 1st, 1957, concluding construction, they've never officially said construction's ended because they moved right into maintenance.
Oh,
and the bridge is continually under maintenance.
I can imagine. I do remember being a reporter in Detroit reporting on that tragic event in 1989 when a young woman in a Yugo who was driving to the UP actually was blown off the bridge by high winds. And there have been other deaths over the years on the bridge, haven't there?
Yeah, there was five during construction and then six other deaths on the bridge over the years.
Hmm. And am I right that they actually will offer, if you get up there and go, I cannot do this, I'm too afraid, they will drive you across?
They have a couple different services. They can send windbreak trucks over with you if you still have the courage to drive but need a windbreak. Then they also just have driver services, anything from people that have commercial licenses. So if they need to drive your semi-truck across, they can do that all the way down to your motorcycle. Mm. So if your motorcycle has a sidecar, you can just hunker down and they'll drive you across.
Wow. Now, the Mackinac Bridge is designed to move, isn't it? And move it does.
I experienced this firsthand. I crossed Monday, coming back from the Upper Peninsula. There was a high wind advisory, so I think the normal speed limit is 45. It was reduced to 25. As we crossed, we were forced into the center lane, which is the grates. And as my kids marveled at the water below, I noticed that my car was moving quite a bit, more than normal. It wasn't until later I realized that that bridge is designed to be constantly in motion, even up to 35 feet lateral movement in high wind.
35 feet. Stop.
35 feet.
Wow.
Which accounts for why my car was moving so much. It was the bridge.
But that's how it's engineered.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I've heard people that have walked it on the big Labor Day bridge walk that you can feel it swaying. And I guess that makes sense when you have all these people stepping off and each footstep would probably get a vibe going on that bridge.
Yeah, I think the numbers are 50,000 to 75,000 people walk across it.
But bottom line, how safe is the Mackinac Bridge compared to the other big suspension bridges around the country?
It's extremely safe. It's just it's an engineering marvel. It's still the largest suspension bridge in the Western Hemisphere, the third largest in the world. And when you think about the engineering marvel that it is, it was opened only 17 years after the infamous Galloping Gertie Bridge collapsed in Tacoma, Washington, which was a much smaller suspension bridge.
Well, well done to the crew and engineers who put it all together. The opening 60 years ago this day. So State Archivist Mark Harvey helping us mark the 60th birthday of the Mackinac Bridge. Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Mackinac Bridge.
The Mackinac Bridge.
She's a mighty fine bridge.
She's a mighty fine bridge.
500 feet high.
500 feet high.
5 miles long.
5 miles long.
In the Straits of Mackinac, there's about as much water as you ever saw. The folks who lived there tried and tried, but they couldn't get across to the other side. Couldn't get across without a boat or a plane. Couldn't take a bus or a trolley or a train. Couldn't swim across, it was cold as a fridge. They thought they better build themselves a bridge. The Mackinac Bridge.
The Mackinac Bridge.
She's a mighty fine bridge.
She's a mighty fine bridge.
500 feet high.
500 feet high.
5 miles long.
5 miles long.
So in 1954, they started linking shore to shore. From Mackinac City to St. Ignace Town, the man on the top didn't dare look down. In 57, the work was through. There she was, all shiny and new. They had a big party and they called out loud, "She's the Mackinac Bridge and we are proud." The Mackinac Bridge.
The Mackinac Bridge.
She's a mighty fine bridge.
She's a mighty fine bridge.
500 feet high.
500 feet high.
5 miles long.
5 miles long.
Bet you're going to find yourself humming that all evening long, whether you want to or not. Here's an invitation for you. Please join me and the entire Stateside team. Tomorrow night, we're doing a live show in East Lansing. We're going to talk with longtime Lansing Mayor Virge Bonero about his legacy. We'll also learn about an MSU program that trains veterans in beekeeping. We'll explore why Lansing is a landing spot for so many refugees and dive into state politics with our It's Just Politics team. We're at the Kellogg Center right there on the MSU campus, 7 o'clock tomorrow evening, November 2nd. We would love to see you there. Register to attend and get details by going to the stateside page at michiganradio.org. And that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so very much for listening.